Good morning. May I start? Good morning. Yesterday we had a great seminar in Medic, and also after that we had dinner with a very, very nice place. Thank you very much, Eve, for arranging many things. Today we have a public session. Then we welcome the people who are participating our public session meeting. First of all, I would like to ask Hans to explain what's going on in the country.
Explain what's going on. Yes, that was last night. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. let me tell you a little bit about what the board has been up to since our last meeting in July. First of all, in terms of the completion of the MOU projects, which has remained the main focus of our work in the last couple of months. in terms of the mandatory rate date of IFRS 9, we have agreed to expose a proposal to move forward the mandatory effective date for IFRS 9 financial instruments from the 1st of January 2013 to the 1st of January 2015. The reason why we have proposed this is that, as you know, the completion of the complete standard has been delayed, and that is the reason why we thought it wise to propose a deferral of the effective mandatory date, and we expect this to be welcomed by the outside world. As regards to offsetting of financial assets and liabilities, we had at first instance reached a converged solution with the ISB and with the FESB. But in June of this year, the ISB and the FASB reached different conclusions. The ISB reached a unanimous vote to stick to the course, which was to allow offsetting only in limited cases, and we voted 15-0 for that, up from 14-1 in the first vote. For the exposure draft, unfortunately, the FASB voted 4-3 not to proceed as proposed. The first vote on their side was 3-2, and the two new members voted against proceeding as proposed. That was quite a disappointment. What we are going to try to do now, though, is to have converged disclosures so that the trained analyst at least can reconcile the numbers. Still remains the fact that at face value, the balance sheet of American banks and banks that are reported under IFRS 4 will look quite different. Difference can be up to 30-40% of the balance sheet. Hedge accounting. We've made a lot of progress on hedge accounting, and we have actually completed our deliberations in September of this year. We have asked the staff to prepare a draft of the final requirements, including application guidance and a basis for conclusions. And the draft will be made available on the ISB website for about 90 days. This st- staff draft will have, this procedure will have two purposes. First of all, it will provide the board with the opportunity to undertake an extended fatal flaw process and additional outreach. It has come to my attention that some user groups are a bit wary of hedge accounting. They find it complicated. They think it's too much prepare-orientated. And I think many of these misgivings are based on a lack of understanding, so we would like to use this these 90 extra days to do some additional outreach. And what is also important is that we wish to give the FASB, who are way behind on the developing proposals for hedge accounting, we want to give them the opportunity to have a further consideration of our plans, of our proposals, and to so that they can make up their mind whether they wish to come on board or not. Then impairment. During a meeting of the Advisory Council, where I was giving this same report early in the morning, I demonstrated my feelings of exasperation on this issue. It's extremely difficult to do. Whenever we propose something that makes a lot of economic sense, it turns out not to jive with the internal management methods of the and systems of the banks themselves. Which in itself is completely understandable, but then when we try to work our way around it, it becomes extremely complicated, and we have to do all sorts of artificial bypasses, which threatens to make the accounting either very complicated or counterintuitive. For example, by leading to quite substantial day one losses for newly extended loans, which is completely counterintuitive because, we have been through a period in which indeed loans that were bound to fail were indeed made because the banks were able to pass them on to unwitting investors through CDOs. Our feeling is that hopefully this time, this business model will be over, and normally a bank would, even if it makes a risky loan, it would compensate itself for that by asking for a higher interest rate. So overall, a risky loan portfolio, even if it's riskier than a regular loan portfolio, should not lead to day one losses. It should overall be profitable, otherwise the banks would not engage in these kind of credit risks. So we're still working on that. We're working closely with the banking community. We're working closely with the regulators. We still feel this is extremely important, but it's not an easy path. Next week we will have a further meeting with the FASB to see how we can get out of these problems. Classification and measurement. We have completed our work in 2009 and 2020 on liabilities. The FASB has been working on its own proposals, has reached conclusions that at times are quite different from ours. The FASB and the ISB have agreed that we will take time to look at our proposals to see whether we are able to come closer together than we currently are. And I expect that in the near future we should hopefully be able to take this look and hopefully come to conclusions. Leasing obligations are widely considered to be a significant source of balance sheet financing. Not everybody agrees with that, but still that remains our analysis, and the objective is of this new standard is to improve financial reporting by lessors and lessees. The boards published a joint exposure draft in August of last year, and during this year, the ISB and FASB have been considering the comments received. In July 2011, we, on all major points, we had reached convergence. We had not yet completed all of our deliberations, but we had received, or we had reached pretty firm conclusions, and we decided that we had sufficient information available to conclude that we would re-expose the proposals, given their wide-reaching impact and the importance of the matter, and the fact that on some issues we have been going back and forth, and we wanted the outside world, our constituents, to be able to take a closer look at our proposals. We expect to complete our deliberations in October, and which is very soon, and we will then prepare to prepare our revised exposure draft. And we will probably decide on a common period of 120 days. And like any ED, it will have a full basis for conclusions and any related application guidance and illustrative examples. The exposure draft is expected to be issued in the February of 2012. Revenue recognition, another joint product with the FASB. Exposure draft we produced in June 2010. I already reported in July that the boards have reached common decisions, and that we also here decided to re-expose our revised proposals, even though we felt it was our due process rules did not really necessitate it. But given the fact that this is such an incredibly important standard, given the importance of the revenue number to all companies and the need to take all possible steps to avoid unintended consequences, we felt it wise to re-expose. Comment deadline expected to be in 2012. And we'll do quite a bit of outreach in the next couple of months. We, for example, intend to hold public discussions on our proposals in May 2012 in London, Norwalk, and Tokyo. Then, finally, some non-convergence projects, insurance contracts. We were first planning to publish the next due process documents for insurance by the end of 2011. This is now not expected to happen until at least the first half of 2012. Also here, the boards have reached different decisions on several basic matters. In addition, the ISB has already published an exposure draft, whereas the FASB has only published a discussion paper. And the boards are assessing now how to best address these differences and how to align the timetables so that the outcome is identical or at least closely converged final standards. And if the ISB re-exposes the insurance contract proposals, it will align the project timetables. Another challenge is the relationship between the insurance contracts project and the financial instruments project. Obviously, there's a close interrelationship between the two. And we have also made it clear that the ISB will need to ensure that the insurance contract standard and financial instruments requirements work well together. So that's something else to look at. Let me see, Chairman. I think I can come to a conclusion here.
Are there any comments or questions?
Maybe, Aki, it might be worth at this point to have the discussion about the letter, plans that you sent. I know a number of trustees are interested in the process that you followed for that, and some views on if that was the right process or not. So maybe in your report, that's the right place to deal with it.
Sure. The letter to ESMA about the inconsistent application of our financial instrument standards in terms of the treatment of Greek government debt. The origins of the letter, I could say, could already go back a little bit of time. Among both the board and the staff, we felt ill at ease because, on the one hand, the outside world, among whom regulators are really asking us to work hard on this impairment, these impairment rules, which I just talked about. And the main impetus of their request is, please make it possible to take losses early in the process at a more timely moment, and that we don't get a repetition of the current financial crisis, where also because of the effects of the incurred loss model, the current incurred loss model, losses are only taken at a very late stage when they are totally inevitable, and then they all come together. And you get a very pro-cyclical way of taking losses in the system. So that was happening on the one hand. On the other hand, while we were doing this work, which keeps my staff up very late at night, we were witnessing that at the same time there were obvious problems. For example, with Greek debt, and many investors for months and months have considered this debt severely impaired. It was trading at very steep discounts in the markets. And in any case, no normal person would be willing to pay 100 cents on the dollar or the euro for these bonds, obviously impaired. And even under the current incurred loss model. At the same time, we saw that banks were generally extremely hesitant in recognizing these losses. Then came the moment when this could no longer be denied, limited restructuring of Greek debt, and all audit firms and banks had to recognize, yes, now we have an impairment. Probably late, but better late than never. What happened then? Well, you have to look at, when you have an impairment, you have to look at the standard to see what you have to do. The standard clearly says when a debt is impaired, you have to look at the market values when you have the debt available for sale. You look at the market values and then you write it off to those market values. Market values at the time were close to 50%. What we saw happening then, and we were getting signals from the market, and it could simply be seen from quarterly statements, that banks throughout Europe were doing this in an inconsistent manner. This was not a difference of some banks doing it at 52% and some other banks doing it at 45%. No, these were differences between 21%, which were the official terms of the new restructuring, and 50% or something like that, which were the going market rates. And quite frankly, my staff and also board members felt rather upset about this situation because we felt it was a blatant, what was in any case clear that there was inconsistency. Inconsistency is very bad. Inconsistent application is very bad for the integrity of our standards. A lot of people in the outside world who are not friendly towards IFRS say, yes, you have all these countries applying IFRS, but, you know, the truth is they all do it in different ways. So what is it worth, this global standard? And we all feel that this is very important, and that's why the main reason why in our strategy paper we have, and a strategy review, we have very clearly written down that we're going to cooperate very clearly, very closely with enforcers, with regulators, to promote proper and consistent application of our standards, knowing full well that we don't have a direct role there. That's the role of the enforcers. But we can help, for example, by writing very clear standards that are clearly understandable to all, that don't give way to inconsistent interpretation, and also by closely communicating with regulators if we see things going on that, according to us, are not according to the rules or which are clearly inconsistent. I believe it is our right and almost our duty to give a signal to the regulators about that. So that was at least my feeling. It was a feeling of members of the staff and what to do in this situation. I came to the conclusion that it would be wise to send a letter to the authorities in charge, ESMA. ESMA in itself doesn't have direct enforcement powers, but it is the cooperative body of all the enforcers in Europe. And I knew if I write to ESMA, I write to all the national regulators, because they are all part of ESMA and they will all get the letter. I wrote a letter. Of course, the staff helped me with that. I consulted with a couple of three or four or five board members on the content, and should we do it this way? We changed a little bit the way in which we did it. We changed the content of the letter a little bit, took some sharp edges off, and then I sent the letter to ESMA. I did not consult with the whole board. This was not a board decision. Also, the board is not together all the time. And we felt speed was important here. But I did get a feeling of some key board members, also European board members, who had also had a sense of the political situation. And I'll be honest, some board members were more hesitant than others, but all in all, I felt this was the right thing to do. So I wrote to ESMA. It was a private letter. I did on purpose also not circulate it widely, because I did not want it to leak. And actually, after 2 weeks, when it still had not leaked, I thought, this is not going to leak, and then calls started coming in. Obviously, what came... it had been, the letter had been sent to all the national regulators, and somewhere it started leaking through the system, and many people read it at a certain point. When I heard indications that it was about to leak, I sent, we advised Bob that this was going to happen, and gave him a letter of a copy of the letter. Thinking back about the timing of that, I think it might have been better to send a copy of this sensitive issue at an earlier stage to Bob, but at least when it became publicly a sensitive matter, the trustees were informed. Now, looking at the results of all this, it was, of course, not a very pleasant site, and there was quite a bit of publicity, but still I feel good about what we did. I also think that the ultimate outcome of this, and I've received clear indications, is that at the end of this year we will have consistent application in Europe, and that might have happened even without having written the letter, because we were not the only ones that were noticing these inconsistencies. Analysts were noticing them, newspapers were noticing them, and the regulators obviously must have noticed it too. So even without our letter, something might have happened. My feeling, though, is that the publicity around our letter, even though we did not look for it, but that it did have a positive influence on the discussion. I know it has been awkward for some banks, but then again, I mean, this was a pretty clear-cut case, and if you want to show the outside world that you can handle these problems, which every bank is trying to do in Europe, then why do this? I sincerely do not understand it. I think the standards are very clear in this case, and even if the markets are illiquid, as some people say, then you still have to look at the closest market values, and the closest market values were not 21%. They were 50% or something to that effect. So I think we were fully entitled to do what we did. I also think that the effect of it was positive.
First, I want to confirm, of course, what Tom said. He did indeed send a copy in due course to us. I also want to just point out that our strategy paper makes clear the importance we give to consistency of application and enforcement, and also makes clear that we, more importantly, the board is totally dependent upon, in the final case, regulators in the various countries for that consistency of application and consistency of enforcement, so that reaching out to country regulators through ESMA is completely consistent with what we say in our strategy review. And indeed, this is an issue that we believe, based on, among other things, the comments that we've received, of utmost importance.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Hans, for your explanation. But I have to say, I was very surprised when I learned the existence of such a letter by Tom's email after leaks in the press. And I think it would be useful to have some explanation from ISB. Perhaps it's my proposal. Now it would be useful to have more process rules in this kind of situation. Almost if there are significant tensions in already sensitive markets, with the risk to increase again volatility and instability. But I'd like to repeat the facts. Greek bonds impairments has been heavily discussed with both ESMA and EBA for a long time, and these two organizations failed to achieve any sort of consensus. So, a private letter, and for me the question, in this case, a private letter is a good tool. In these conditions, a private letter from the ISB chair might be interpreted as a tentative to support certain lines to detriment to the others. And this perception was reinforced because it was a private letter not posted in the ISB site. So I think it's a concern in terms of oversight process. So I have four questions. Perhaps you have answer for part of them. There were four questions and one suggestion. My first question is, what are the IB's responsibility to verify the implementation and more interpretation of the standards, or what are the organizations are in charge to assure correct implementation and application of our standards? And so it would be useful to be clear what the chair of the responsibility. Second question is, in this case of situation, the chairman, board chairman, had access to all the information that we would expect having necessary before forming a raised opinion on whether or not IFRS are properly or were properly applied in those jurisdictions. So, did he know the IIF decisions? Did he know the CAC certifications? Or is the same companies on the certificate, not with the same figures? For me, it's curious, but probably there are some reasons. Third, could Chairman Board ISB appreciate the liquidity of all the market at each moment, and who can decide a market is inactive? Third question: why the board was not consulted? Fourth question: why no public information? And I think, and my conclusion on my suggestions. For me, we have to be very cautious, to be very transparent. We are very cautious to avoid confusions of responsibility between institutions. We are very cautious to preserve independence of each institution. And we have to assure total transparency in the ISB decision-making power and communication. And perhaps, but it's my suggestion, we can find, or you can find, kind of reflect to establish a clear and more formalized working process with ESMA or other regulators to have guidelines to deal with this kind of situation and to avoid each misunderstanding. I have to be clear. I want to intervene in your responsibility. I preserve totally your independence, but to preserve that, we have to be clear, to have formalized and transparent. If not, you have a lot of misunderstanding. That's what I will. Thank you.
Well, first of all, I'm in full agreement with your letter and with your action. But the question that it raises in my mind is that the board is assuming upon itself the responsibility to correct inconsistent interpretation of our standards. So is this the first time that the board does this? And does this mean that, you know, you're going to have some people on your staff ensuring that a consistent implementation by the regulators is taking place, or otherwise, you will jump in and you will correct the wrong interpretation. So given the seriousness and the visibility of the issue and so on, I'm very comfortable. It was obvious to you and your staff that a wrong interpretation was being applied, and you decided to step in because of the seriousness of the subject matter and so on. But we have to think through on a longer term what are the implications for the organization.
Thank you. Obviously, there was a real issue, but I'd want to put that one on one side, because I agree with what I think is an emerging view, best articulated by Eve, that really here we have a matter of process, and it's a delicate matter of process, because as Eve made clear, and I entirely agree, we must be extremely careful not to impinge upon the proper independence of the board. So it would seem to me the right way forward, because this issue may come up again, and you have the issue of the respective roles. For example, it isn't clear to me what I did hear last night, Stephen Mayor talking about powers that ESMA has. But it would seem to me a good way forward would be for informal discussions between the chair of due process and Hans to work out how these things might be handled in an appropriately transparent way, with trustees being sufficiently aware, with a process, without impinging upon the independence of the board, and bearing in mind that this issue of enforcement is high in our strategy and is certainly going to emerge. So now might be a good time to start doing some work on that.
I agree, actually, with a lot of what has been said. I think that I agree that we need to be building whatever feedback mechanism is required with security regulators globally, because I think we have identified in the strategy paper that that is a gap. And the one jurisdiction I know well, which is the U.S., there is a very active dialogue when there is a current issue that needs to get resolved, and it's a And Harvey can probably add more insight into this, but it's a very iterative process where there's a discussion between the SEC and the FASB about exactly what the issue is and how guidance should be issued. Should it be something that comes out of the securities regulator? Should it be done by the FASB? I think this is a very, our circumstance is that we want to build a process where we actively engage where we see something with the people who can enforce the standards. So I think this is a process question, as we've heard. I think one of the things I would suggest is that we find we communicate with the security regulators about how would they like that mechanism to work when we see things, whether they might be things that come up for the implementation committee. There may be other sources of issues which can't go through a lengthy process and where the board is very clear. So I think getting some agreement with security regulators about how that type of communication should occur would be step one. I do think that there should be a bit of a bias that there is some internal due process within the board about the quality of what we're doing before it's done. I have no issue with this particular one, but you don't want to stub your toe on a future issue. And then finally, I do think there should be a willingness when we send these, we know they're going to leak. What is the communication with trustees, et cetera? I think we should work on that. So in summary for me, I think we do need to work out how we're going to do this with the regulators. Secondly, I think we should have an internal process to ensure that it's done completely thoroughly. And thirdly, I think there should be a communication on the basis that nothing ever stays quiet.
Who else? Harvey. Okay. Harvey?
I agree that we have to develop a process. There's nothing more important in the next group of years than the consistent application issue. On the other hand, it is a major concern right now, and Hans, acting with those he consulted on the board, for me at least, was clearly correct on the merits. I think the lesson to be learned for the board or for trustees is to think about a process for inconsistent application. How should we work it out? How should we deal with it in the future? In a period where there was no time to think about the future and there was a serious matter of concern, on the merits, for me, was completely correct.
Son?
I agree with Harvey. I want to first say that I think given the state of the process as defined, Hans did exactly the right thing. There is no question in my mind that these decisions of inconsistent application were made with forethought and consultation between audit firms, banks, and regulators. And I think that is a poor example of reporting. And for us to not have responded in some way would have been wrong. Now, I do agree that a process that is well-defined would make us more effective at putting the right answer out and have given Hans the roadmap. But this is very different than dealing inside a single jurisdiction with a single regulator, where you can get the head of the FASB and the head of the chief accountant of the SEC on the phone and talk to an issue. These regulators knew exactly, in my mind, what they were doing. And the audit firms, of which I was once part of, took inconsistent positions on different banks with the same facts, which I find amazing. So I think it was an imperative for us to say, if nothing else, and as I read your letter, Hans, it said, hey, guys, if you're not paying attention, somebody needs to look at this, because this is clearly not what we would view to be consistent application of the standard. So, yes, a process, but if we build a process that takes weeks to respond to, then we might as well not have a process. These issues are going to all be exactly like this. They're going to be overnight, highly stressful. They will be mostly done with knowledge, and we'll have to put something on the table to raise the stakes. And so it has to be a very fast process. But I go back to my first statement. I think Hans did the right thing.
So, Bob?
Obviously, I'm speaking just for myself, but I think I'm, in effect, underlining what Sam just said. I think what was done in this case was entirely proper and necessary, and there was need for action in this case because, simply put, we cannot be a global standard setter if we write standards and they are not consistently applied. And this isn't my notion dreamt up in the middle of the night. This is what we hear from commentator after commentator after commentator. And it is an important issue as the SEC considers the matter of U.S. adoption, and should be. So I think this was the right act. It was a necessary act. The other dimension that Sam has pointed to is the need to get our arms around process. And I think we need to do that, and I think we should look to the deliberations of the Due Process Oversight Committee to develop that process. But again, I would also add that it can't be a process that is elongated and takes for a long time. But I'm fully comfortable and indeed support what the IASB chairman did in this case.
And can I make one more comment? I'm not sure that I totally appreciate the concern around independence that's been articulated. Maybe I could better understand where some people have concern, nor do I think we cross the line from a standard setter to an enforcer. I think the letter itself made it very clear, as I read the letter, that it was not our job to enforce. It was the job of the regulator to enforce. We just wanted to be sure the regulator was aware of the fact that there was a broad inconsistency taking place in the market. And so I do not think we crossed the line from standard setter to regulator. I do think that it does set a precedent that is a good one, that when we see these issues, we should bring them to the attention of the broad marketplace. And in this case, it happened to be inside the European Union.
Who?
Thank you, Chairman. Just a couple of comments from my perspective as chair of the Advisory Council, which met just earlier this week. And Hans did give a report on activities, did comment in specifically on his frustrations about coming up with a new impairment model. Hans did not deal specifically with this letter, but it was a matter of public record. I was certainly aware of it. The council for the last 2 years or more has consistently said the number one issue going forward is consistency of interpretation application. No one at the meeting or before the meeting or after has raised with me through the advisory council a concern about this letter, which is by now widely known. So I draw some inferences from that. I did not raise a concern because the letter was very carefully worded. I admired Hans' performance last night. It's very difficult to keep the proper perspective. The letter, as I read it, didn't say what the right answer was. It said the issue is a significant diversity in practice. And on that basis, in my capacity as a Advisory Council member. I thought that was an appropriate and timely observation. Speaking from personal experience as a former chair of a Canadian board that went through a very similar experience, not as many zeros, but a lot that mattered to our economy, where there was no trading, same sorts of issues about how do you come up with a reasonable estimate of market value. And I think that the one observation I would make is consistent with the notion of process here. The way of finding a balance, I think, is the board must, I think, and I think the advisory council would think, must have a role to play as a facilitator. We could see this problem coming. In hindsight, perhaps if some process was in place to bring the various parties to a table, that if the board has a role to play in that process, that would be helpful. And that is indeed what happened in Canada with our asset-backed commercial paper freeze-up. It took a while, but the board played a role as facilitator, and it did, over a period of months, get a significant degree of convergence. But that convergence and consensus came from those who had the responsibility to make the decision, not from the board.
Let me say that I want to join the remarks of numerous people here around the table for the need of action. And in this slide, I wanted to stress one point, and that was made by Hans, because at the end, I think that an inconsistent application of the standards at the end will backfire to ourselves. Last month, I have been approached by numerous people who were quite critical, not only about the way auditors operated, accountants operated, Sam, but also by the fact that there is clearly quite a room to maneuver within the IFRS standards itself. And they said, well, if that's the case, what is really the beef of IRS standards? So I think that a letter to show and to remind everybody that there was less room to maneuver for this for all these banks, I think was, well, let's say, rather justified.
Thank you. Pedro.
Yes, yesterday in the debate you made a very good point, which you haven't repeated here, but it's worth recalling the members which were not there. You said that you have not written the letter if the information were that the range of variation between the 21% politically agreed on July 21 and some decisions that other banks in Europe have taken about this discount on Greek debt were a very shorter one. But say 21 to 51 is a very wide thing, showing the question of inconsistency of replication, which so many people have talked about here. So we knew from the very beginning of this this crisis that this would create new issues for the relationships between regulators, supervisors, and standard setters in addressing the situation. Yesterday, as mentioned, someone occurred to my mind listening to some conversations over the last several days. Quote from Rudy Dornbusch, who is a first-rate economist, now deceased, but he said that in economics, things take longer to happen than you think they will. And then they happen much faster than you thought they could. And we are observing this, and I'm sure we will continue to observe these types of situations. So while I'm supporting your letter, I think David has a point. Given that this similar types of issues are bound to come again, and I don't think we should be in the business of writing letters every time we see one of the inconsistencies that are appearing in the attempt to deal with the crisis. It may be helpful to try to think, perhaps in the framework of the Due Process Committee, conversations with David and your people, how would they, we'd handle similar situations as we move forward. For instance, I think at some point in time, it may have been helpful to just circulate prior to sending to trustees, well, on a non-objection base, we intend to circulate this. If you don't, if I don't hear from you till the close of business of day X, I will assume that you have no objection. And so something like that. But we, I think we should have a process for this, because there will be many, many opportunities, I'm afraid, and I regret very much to say so, that we will be observing inconsistencies in the application of the standards. And if we feel the need of every time that we read or take knowledge of one of them to have a letter quickly sent, I think we may be overburdening our agenda and creating unnecessary problems to ourselves.
Okay, thank you very much. Having heard your comment and opinion, I would like to suggest that the very general support of the letter issued, but we need to have some sort of process. David, DPOC will discuss this matter with ISB, that what kind of communication or process is needed.
Yeah, Chairman. First of all, when I applied for this position, and you asked me what my motivation was, I made it very clear that my main motivation was that the traumatic experience of the crisis that we are in now, which was caused by economic standards and business standards going down the drain, by regulators being bossed around by banks and other private interests to weaken their supervision, which led to a complete dressing down of the supervision of banks and them becoming completely undercapitalized, by accountancy rules that made it possible to have to separate special purpose vehicles that were indeed still economically very closely tied to banks, but to keep them apart, to keep your capital levels as low as possible. And by lots of people looking the other way, when they all knew that standards were either too low of low quality or not being properly applied. And my motivation to do this job is to get high quality standards and to do a little bit in the world to get them properly applied. And obviously, I don't see it as the task of the ISB to ensure proper application of standards. We cannot do that. We only have, it's not our mission. We only have 120 people, and I cannot ask my staff to, this took 2 days' work, I think, for my staff. I cannot do them, ask them to do this every day, and not every month, and probably not every year. But I'm telling you, if I see this happening again, and I have to give a speech the next day, I will probably not even send a letter, but I'll say it in a speech, because I'm not going to be quiet, and I'm not going to go into all kinds of bureaucratic processes when I see blatant wrongdoings. And I know from our expertise in our organization that things are going blatantly wrong. I am not going to first to go into a bureaucratic process to see whether everybody agrees that indeed it is blatant and I can write a letter. I'm not going to do that. So let me be completely clear about that. And you saw me operating yesterday during a debate. I'm very outspoken. People generally appreciate it because it is in this world, it is not very useful, or it's not generally the case that people speak their mind, except when they're criticizing us. I'm going to stand up for this organization, and I'm going to stand up for our standards. And I will be happy to talk with as many people as possible, but I'm not going to be dragged down in bureaucracy. And did I have all the information to verify whether it should be 21% or 50%? No, I didn't, and that's why I didn't take a definitive conclusion in the letter. Paul Sherry noted that. That was a very carefully worded letter. All it basically said, there is a very big difference, not a difference between 48 and 52, but a very big difference. Please take a look at it. That's all it did. And I made a very blunt comparison yesterday. If you see that your neighbor's house is being burgled, it may be your civic duty to do something about it, but it's not your duty to try and catch the thief. You go to the police and call them and ask them, please, I think something is wrong there. Could you please take a look? That's all that happened. Why not public information about this? I saw, of course, that it was a sensitive issue. We could have chosen to make the letter public immediately. And as I said, had I had the opportunity of a speech that week, I might have chosen that too, to notice this issue. And I might have called publicly for ESMA to take a look at this. I was not the only one seeing this. There were articles in the newspapers that were noticing this. So I might have done that. But I thought, all of the things being considered, it was probably wise to keep it low profile, to not generate publicity, and to not get the suspicion that we were just out there to create this publicity. I wanted to keep it low profile. That's basically what I wanted to do. That's why I didn't circulate it all around the world, and that's why I wrote a private letter to ESMA, to keep it technical, clear, but technical. That's why I thought that was the wise thing to do. So then in terms of the future, working with ESMA, I know these people very well. I was part of ESMA before it was called ESMA. I see them all the time, all of them. I think that Sam made a very wise remark. This is a very different relationship than between FASB and the SEC. SEC has clear powers, is one single regulator for a whole clear constituency jurisdiction. With ESMA is more complicated, but I do think that there is probably a need for some regular consultation with ESMA about what do you see, what are your concerns. And by the way, ESMA writes me letters too. They wrote me a letter about two of our standards, which they didn't like, and could we please change them? And nobody in our board mentioned that, no, we cannot accept this letter because it's not the job of ESMA to change standards, our job, so they should not send us letters. So, by the way, we were about IFRIC. IFRIC was about to lay the request aside, and I personally intervened in the board to say, listen, this is a serious request from the regulators. We cannot just put this aside to wait for the future and deal with it. We have to deal with it now. And that's the way how I feel that regulators and standard setters should act together. And that's how I think I should proceed with my board.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We understand the situation. So that the David DPOC with the enhanced to develop some sort of process to be clear to the public and also secure our position for the public interest.